All right. Well, we've just started the book of Esther. And if you weren't here, we covered a little bit of the book, my gospel meeting, and then vacation is kind of unfortunate timing because we just got started in the with this book. So let's kind of lay the background again to the book of Esther. One of the things we find, and we have even found with our studies of various individuals in the Bible, God seems to raise up people at the right time. And it's always needed and necessary. You remember, of course, in Egypt, he raised up, first of all, Joseph. In Babylon, raised up Daniel at the right time to do special things. And now we see the same thing with the book of Esther. And as we think about the background to Esther, again, this is during the time when they had been taken off into captivity. And during that 70 years of Babylonian captivity, God, again, raised up certain individuals who played an important part, men like Zerubbabel, of course, Daniel first in the very beginning. But towards the end, when the people are liberated and they start going back home, there Zerubbabel and Ezra, of course, Nehemiah. Zerubbabel led the first group of Jews back home, you recall, about 50,000 of them. And Ezra, of course, played the spiritual role. He was kind of the spiritual leader of the people. He and Nehemiah led the reconstruction of the city of Jerusalem and the walls of Jerusalem back home. And so all of them were, you know, very significant, played very significant roles. But none of that would have been possible if it wasn't for Esther and how God raised her up. And she intervened. Of course, as we think about the book of Esther, the very existence of the people of God comes under attack. And so she plays a huge role in being the one who is able to prevent their destruction from taking place. And so the book of Esther, from that standpoint, is a very important, a very unique book. It's one of the only two books in the Bible, Song of Solomon, the other one, where God is not named. So God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. But his providence is all over the book. The book of Esther probably sets forth the providence of God more heavily than any other book in the Bible. And the only rival to it would be in Genesis with the story of Joseph. That is filled with the providence of God. But the story of Esther is filled with that. So we see the sovereignty of God in the book of Esther, even though he's not mentioned in the book. And the period of time here, as we get into it, we read just a little bit of it last time we had the class. So Xerxes is the king of Persia this time. He reigned for 21 years over the Persian Empire. And he's the first main character that comes to light in the book. He reigned from about 486 B.C. to 465 B.C., so 21 years. And Esther, in the book, her story of her life, took place between 483 and 473, and falls historically between Ezra 6 and 7. So if you read that book, that's the life of Esther, and all that we read in this book actually fits right in there between Ezra 6 and 7. And so that's kind of the history of it, or where it is in history. And as we begin reading the book again, I think covered about the first 9 or 10 verses last time, but been so long. Let's just get it before us again. It says, "Now in the days of Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in the days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of the reign, he gave a feast for all of his officials and servants, the army of Persia and Media, And the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and the pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And so we revealed again, obviously don't remember all who was here last time, but you remember this is kind of a celebration that went on for 6 months. And right away, we see what kind of man this was. Ahasuerus was not a very good king. I mean, he failed in a lot of different ways. He failed as a man in a lot of different ways. And again, he's one of the main characters of the story of Esther. But we see that he was worldly, prideful. He just was really concerned about what other people thought about him. He wanted to show off his power, his riches, the glory of his palace, and all of that. But there's something else behind this. As we pointed out last time, he wants to go on a campaign against Greece. And so that really is what he's doing. He's gathering together his army and the governors, all the nobles, to get them to agree to this campaign. And like, he could just force it if he wanted to, because he's the king. But, this was at least one smart thing that he attempted to do, to get favor of everybody, to get people working together for all of this. It said that he's doing all of this because Greece, particularly the Athenians, defeated his father, and he's going after revenge. But I'm sure that's true. But even more than that, he just wants to expand his kingdom because he's greedy. He wants more power and all of that. And so all of that plays a part. And so he has this 6 month celebration. At the end of it, verse 5, it says, "And when these days were completed, the king gave for all of the people present in Susa the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace." And again, I'm reading the king, the ESV, so it says Susa. It's the same as Shushan. It's just a different form of it. But now he throws a second feast, and he's showing off again all that he has. There was white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods, marble pillars, and also couches of gold. Like, all kings who have power and their palaces and things are magnificent. That's always the case, really. But yeah, I mean, you just read this and you can see he's over the top. I mean, he is very materialistic. Like, couches of gold, really? You think of all, you read the rest of that. We don't have to read all of it, but you just see he's just, even the drink, I think last time we pointed out the verse 7, the drinks were served in golden vessels of different kinds. And the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. And so, again, people weren't commanded to drink or anything, but they could drink all they wanted to. And listen, you just see how unwise this is, that this edict went out of all the staff of the palace to do as each man desired. Like, that's a dangerous thing to do, isn't it, when you think about that? I mean, to open things up like that is just careless. I think of, sometimes this is something totally, totally different, but just the idea of opening things up. Have you ever been at a congregation where they give announcements and at the end the announcer will say, "Does anybody have anything?" Like, yikes, don't do that. And I've been a lot of places like that. And then people just start, it can get out of control. It's like when I'm in gospel meetings, sometimes I don't know the timing all the time. When the Bible class, I'll ask somebody, how much time do I have? And then somebody will inevitably say, go as long as you need. All right. And I never do that, really. But to open something up, just let people do whatever they want, is dangerous. Now, you think about a drunken situation like this. People are getting drunk, and you just do whatever the king setting forth an edict, do whatever man desired. I mean, that's careless as a king, isn't it? And that's the kind of king he is. He has no real control. And he doesn't really have that much control of his own family. And he's just not a very good king at all. And that is revealed to his destruction in his own life. If we went into detail about his life, it was a careless, out of control life. He just wanted power, but even more than that, he wanted riches, material things, and he was a man full of pride. And so that is a problem. One of the things we learn in this first chapter, just again with him, since he's the first character introduced, is just the problems of pride and where it can get us, the problems it can cause for us. We all, I think, remember in the book of Proverbs, in Proverbs chapter 16, a familiar statement, even though, you know, we don't have the power and clout at our disposal that he had, still pride can get us in trouble. You remember verse 18? I'm sure you recall this, Proverbs 16 at verse 18. Pride goes before destruction. Well, that was certainly true with him. And we'll see how this plays out in his life here in just a few minutes. But pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. It is better to be of lowly spirit with the poor than to divide the spoil with the proud. And so again, you know, we too, our lives can spin out of control if we're overwhelmed with pride. And then when you add a materialistic element to that, then things really get out of control. You're full of pride and you love material things and you even have access to material things. What happens is what we read about here in the book of Esther. This king, you know, having a celebration for 6 months. And then a feast for 5 days that just everybody do whatever you want to do. Every man doing what he desires, whatever he pleases to do, is the result of all of that. Well, his pride begins to kick in even more. Verse 9, Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus on the seventh day when the heart of the king was merry with wine. What happens when you get drunk? People get drunk and do things they regret. We're going to find here, particularly when we get into the beginning of chapter 2, it is at least hinted at that he now begins to make decisions that he regrets later on. And that's not unusual for the drunkard. And so it is, one of the most unwise thing to do is ever put yourself in a state where you're not sober and you don't know what you're doing and you might regret later decisions that you make. And that's the case with him. And so he's merry with wine. He commands Mahuman, Bistha, Harbonia, Bigtha, and Abatha, Zithar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who serve in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. That's about where we closed, I think, last time, and we won't get bogged down. I don't think we even did last time about exactly what that means. It goes everywhere with commentators, and you know, many commentators state specifically that he was asking her to come out with nothing but her royal crown, and perhaps, you know, we don't know. Most conclude that he wanted her to do something lewd, but we don't know. At the very least, as you just read the text, he wanted to show her off bring her out as a trophy to show off her beauty. And so it was a mistreatment, particularly of a queen, but of any woman to do that. And so to her credit, she refuses to do it. And this is all providential. At verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command and delivered by the eunuch. And so it says that this time the king became enraged and his anger burned within him. So again, you know, we don't know a whole lot about Queen Vashti. And she was at the end of the day a Persian queen. And there are things stated about her that aren't the nicest things from extra-biblical material. But here, at least, she's held in a good light. Like, she refuses to let go of her integrity. Whatever he was requesting of her, she wouldn't do it. And you notice he's enraged by it. What would most kings do who are enraged at this kind of thing, when their wives openly disobey them? Put them to death. Put the wife to death. Not unusual at all for one of these kind of kings to kill a wife, to murder their wife or children. It happens all the time throughout history. These kind of men with all this power, you know, you embarrass them openly and publicly, put him to death. But he doesn't do it. Why? I mean, it could be that he had so much love for her that he's just angry and wouldn't do it. Maybe didn't really have the backbone to make these kind of decisions. One thing we do know, we don't know if this played a part, but his son, who would eventually take the throne in his stead, Artaxerxes was born this very year. This is 3 years into his reign, and so it's now 483 B.C., and that's the year he was born. So it's very probable that Vashti is pregnant with him even now. And so if that was the case and he knows that, then that would cause him, you know, to not execute her. So, you know, which one of those scenarios played out? It's very unusual that he did not have her immediately executed. In fact, to her credit, it's what really shows us whatever characteristics she had overall, she was very courageous. And again, had at least the integrity not to be marched out in front of a bunch of drunken men and march around just because her husband wanted her to. And she could have, under normal circumstances, lost her life. And there's no way she could have known that she wouldn't be put to death in doing this. But for whatever the reason is, he's angry, but notice how he responds to this. It's at verse 13, it says, then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure towards all who were versed in law in judgment. Now, so he calls in the wise men. These men who are supposed to be savvy from a cultural standpoint and experts with the law. And that, so he calls them in. And you say, well, what's wrong with the king having advisors? I mean, nothing. All kings had advisors, didn't they? We see it throughout the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar, others, they would often call in the astronomers and wise men. Nothing unusual about that. But they never called in their wise men for this. Like, what is this? What would we call this today? What kind of problem was Xerxes having? Huh? A what?
PR, I call it PR.
A PR problem. No doubt. But it was just, at the end of the day, a domestic problem, wasn't it? It was a personal problem. You don't call in wise men, say, hey, my wife won't obey me. What should I do? This is a king who has control over half of the civilized world. from what we would call Pakistan all the way to North Africa, he's in control of. And he has to call wise men in because his wife disobeys an order that he gives. He knows that he's how he's being, because you notice he talks about the law and judgment. He's kind of disguising this in legalities, like, oh, this is a legal matter. I need to bring in all the experts of, no, you don't. The only thing that happened to you is your wife wouldn't obey you. What are you going to do about it? But you notice what it says? This was his procedure. He could hardly make a decision without calling in help. He just wasn't a very good leader. Add that to his being materialistic and again, unwise. We'll see in just a minute, even this campaign wanting to go into Greece was a terrible idea. But he's just not a good leader. And so here he is. So he calls all of these men, Karshina, Sethar, Admatha, Tarsus, Merez, Marshina, and Memucan, and the seven princes of Persia and Media who saw the king's face. They were in his presence a lot and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti? See how he frames that? Because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus. I just call him Xerxes. I can never pronounce that name. Delivered by the eunuchs. Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look on their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. So that's the advice that he gets. So this very day, the noble women of Persia Media who have heard the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials. There will be contempt and wrath aplenty. And if it please the king, let a royal order go out from him and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be, this is kind of important here, it may not be repealed that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give his royal position to another who is better than she. Now, all of that is providential. And it's all paving the way for who? For Esther. But, you know, this is just the way God can operate providentially. You know, all of this is happening naturally. He's using a wicked man, and he's ultimately going to use wicked actions even to bring about his will, which is ultimately to spare his people from destruction. But again, there's nothing done miraculously or anything. He's just able to use bad people sometimes, like Xerxes. And even the ones giving him advice, what do you think about all of this? Hey, you need to get rid of her as queen, Vashti, and make it so she can never appear before you again. Take her crown away and give it to someone else, because what she's doing is going to cause all the women throughout this empire to rebel. What do you think about that? If this was our time, maybe, and you had social media, and the wife of the president rebelled against him somehow, brought him embarrassment, and it probably would travel pretty quickly, but there was no social media back then, was there? How realistic is it to think that this is going to cause all of the women to rebel? Remember the times that we're talking about. Women were mistreated, and it might be too much to say most homes, but in many homes they were mistreated. They would not rebel. They wouldn't have the ability to rebel without serious consequences just because the queen did. you know, just in, just, that's true just in general. Now, things like this could cause some women to rebel. If it got out, there might be some, maybe, who had a little more freedom in their homes than most women did at that particular time that might rebel a little bit. But again, we're talking about 483 BC. You know how long it would take to get this news out? Like, who's going to tell it? The drunken men there in the feast? The women that she was with were the women of the palace. They don't mingle with the common people all over the empire. They're just trying to appease, these officials are just trying to appease the king. And so they exaggerate the situation greatly. I would admit that there's a principle that might apply that it could, like at Corinth, we know that there was a situation where women were rebelling a little bit and it spread through the congregation, but that's contained in a local church. To think that this was going to spread to all peoples and all women and all households is an exaggerated situation. Yeah, go ahead, Matt.
You can tell obviously you guys don't use much common sense, but sometimes it's much easier to tell a person what to do with their situation when they're not in. That was my one here.
Yeah, right.
But until that happens to you, then it's still a different situation. So if you don't have the guys around talking like that, they're just telling you that here's what you should do.
Right.
Because they don't have to deal with it
necessarily. Right. Yes, that's exactly right, but there's one element to it. He is the most powerful man probably on earth right now, and he listens to him. He does exactly what they say he should do. And so he sets forth this decree, and again, as we get into chapter 2, we find that it at least it's hinted at. It doesn't say it specifically. But most agree that he begins to regret what the decision that he made with Vashti. And so let's just jump. We read the rest of this in chapter 1, and again, everything that he does at verse 22, he sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in his own script, to every people in his own language, that every man be master of his own house, his own household, and speak according to the language of his people. So he follows their advice. Now, we jump into chapter 2. And in chapter 2, it says at verse 1, and after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti. And had been, that he remembered Vashti and what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Now, we'll get back to that in just a moment. But here's what you may not realize when you read that. You might connect that back up in chapter 1 when it says, you know, that he was full of rage and everything. He was angry. And then now in chapter 2, verse 1, when his anger abated. But this is not talking about his anger with Vashti. And a hint of that is, you notice his anger abated, and then it says he remembered Vashti. If he was angry, if this anger was with reference to Vashti, why would he have to remember her? I mean, can you be mad at somebody you're not even thinking about? Here's what you don't know about this, just reading it like this. Between chapter 1 and chapter 2, 4 years have passed. 4 years. And the campaign that he wanted so badly to go on against Greece, he went on. And it was an unqualified disaster. He was completely defeated. And so nothing went well. At Thermopylae, there was, when he got there, some of you will recognize, that's the time when 300 Spartans stopped his army. massive army. Just a small band of Spartans stopped them from going forward. He ultimately defeated them, but it delayed them just enough to cause problems. And then later on that year, his navy was completely defeated. He had 1,400 ships. He brought out a throne that they brought from Persia that he sat upon and watched these battles on his throne. You know, what's one of the problems with this king? Pride. Like, who does that? Bring me a throne so I can sit on a throne while I watch these battles. And he watched 1,400 ships be completely destroyed by 380 Greek ships. So things aren't going well. In 479 BC, his army is completely destroyed by the Greeks, almost completely destroyed. And he's out of his mind. He's angry. He's frustrated. He literally almost goes out of his mind. He starts executing people. All the Phoenician admirals that he had, he executed them. He had a bridge built over the Hellespont, and a storm came along. This is no one's fault. A storm came along and destroyed the bridge. He had the engineers beheaded, all of them. Like, he's just out of control. He ordered the waves to be chained. Like, what? He's literally losing his mind. He's so frustrated, humiliated. He had this massive army, the most powerful army on earth at this time. And a small, inferior army has defeated him. He has to go back to Persia in humiliation. And that's where chapter 2 picks up. He's now back home. And he's frustrated and angry, saddened by the whole situation. And guess what he starts to do? He's at home alone now, no comfort. He starts to think about Vashti. And so his anger then abates. And he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Remember, they advised him, you make this so it can't ever be repealed. Because they know, what do you think would happen to these advisors who advised him to get rid of Vashti if she was ever brought back to power? They knew that'd be the end of us. So they had it put in there, you make it so you can't ever repeal this. There's no way Vashti can ever come back into power. And then when it looks like, you know, he's the king. At the end of the day, he could do whatever he wants to. And so most believe that this language, that's why I said earlier, it doesn't say it specifically, but most believe that when it uses this language that he remembered Vashti, that he's missing her. And, you know, he's contemplating, you know, I acted rashly. I was drunk, set forth a decree, all of this. I miss her. He had a harem of women. But lust and love are two different things, aren't they? He misses his wife. But his wise men right away no, wait a minute. We got to send him in a different direction here. Get his mind off of Vashti. So what do they do? It says, then the king's young men who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. And let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young women who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. How do you, this prideful, materialistic king, full of himself, has all the power, your advisors come say, hey, King, we got a good idea for you. You're looking kind of lonely. We're gonna send out for the most beautiful women throughout this kingdom to be brought to you. What do you think he's going to say? That's a terrible idea. No, he likes it. Now, you think about what is going on here. This is brutal. This is a terrible, ungodly situation. Like a lot of times we describe this, oh, there's going to be this great beauty contest. And no, they're not going from place to place and saying, who wants to volunteer to be in this contest where you might maybe end up being the queen? That's not the situation at all. This is closer. It's not exactly, but it's closer to kidnapping than anything else. Like we're told that a lot of people would have lied about their daughters being virgins so they wouldn't be chosen or marry them off very quickly. Because how many people would end up being the queen? Just one. The rest of them would be a part of the king's harem for the rest of their life. No husband ever. No children ever. No visits from the family. No being with the family ever again. They would now be a part of the king's harem for the rest of their life unless they were chosen. If the king had pleasure with one of them, then he would call them by name once in a while just to have sexual relations with them. That's it. Then they would be placed within the group of people who would be his concubines. And that was your life. And in these harems, the women would have, they would be, outside of that terrible situation, they would be treated pretty good because they had to be prepared for having relations with the king. But you think they would be happy? That was a terrible, I mean, you can't hardly think of a more misuse and abuse of women than that. But that was their world. And that's what he's doing. We're even told, we'll get into this, go further next week, that someone has suggested, I can't remember which historian it was, that even Mordecai at first tried to hide Esther, so that she wouldn't be chosen. Because again, this decree went out and it wasn't like everybody was jumping up and down with joy. Like no doubt there would have been a few that said, oh yeah, I'm going to win this. This would be great. I'm going to be the queen. But most of them realized chances are not good and I'm going to be in a harem for the rest of my life. That's not a good situation. But that's the way it was. So that's what we're looking at as we go forward here. But it's all providence and leads to the salvation of the people of God. Very interesting how providence works, isn't it? So we'll pick up there next week.